This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Our guest once again today is Dr. Joanna Lambert, professor at the University of Colorado in Boulder, on the faculty in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology. Lambert also serves as advisor to the United Nations Environmental Program and the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. Dr. Lambert is an elected fellow of both the American Association for the Advancement of Science and the Linnean Society of London. She's published hundreds of scientific articles and several books, and has spent the last 30 years of her career investigating mammal ecology in remote landscapes around the world. Most recently, she's been researching coyotes in areas without wolves, and she spends as much time as she can in wild places, striving for optimism in a changing world. So welcome, Joanna. It's great to be talking with you again. So here we go.
Thank you very much. It's really great to be here again, John. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. So you worked with primates in Africa, in Uganda. When did you start that work, and what was your objective?
So I've been working in Equatorial Africa since 1990. I've been all over the regions of Equatorial Africa from west to east, but mostly my work has been in a rainforest that's in the Ruwenzori Mountains, which borders the Democratic Republic of Congo and Western Uganda, and I'm on the Western Uganda side. And there I have been working with a number of primate species. This forest is known, when I first started working there, it did not have the protected status that it does now. It is now a national park. It became a national park in 1993. And the reason why it became a national park is because it has just extraordinary sort of biological wealth, if you will. It is home to the highest abundance of primates in the world. And meaning there's more sort of primate biomass there than anywhere else. And it's also home to one of the highest species richness, with 13 species all living in the same forest. So over the years, I've studied a number of species in that forest. There's one great ape there, the common chimpanzee. And then there are multiple monkey species. And I've studied red colobus, black and white colobus, red-tailed monkeys, blue monkeys, and gray-cheeked mangabees. And, it's just been an extraordinary pleasure over the years. I still work there to varying degrees, although now my research has also shifted to North America.
Chimpanzees are closely related to humans, more so than any other species. Can you elaborate on this?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I have often said to folks that when I talk about my work that, you know, it's an extraordinary gift to be able to study any wild species.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some species that just, you know, sort of rock you to your core. And chimpanzees are one of those species for me, and for anybody that has ever seen them in the wild. You know, when you see your first chimpanzee in the wild, and you know, the look in their eyes and the way that they look back at you is just so hauntingly familiar, and it's because they are indeed our closest living relative. And you get a feel of that when you see one, for sure. So they are our closest living relative. So what that means is that we share a common ancestor.
Mm-hmm.
But that common ancestor evolutionarily probably dates, it's not fully clear. There are different numbers out there, different numbers, some of which come from fossils, some of which come from various genetic assessments, but probably somewhere between, say, 7 and 9 million years ago, there was some kind of sort of basal, as we call basal ape species, that ultimately evolved into two separate lineages, one lineage leading to common chimpanzees and then bonobos as well, which is another, sometimes called pygmy chimpanzees, and then the other lineage leading to us, right? And we, of course, are just one of many species in the lineage leading to us. We're distinguished from the chimpanzees, both common and pygmy chimpanzee, by the fact that we have a bipedal ancestry. And so we share a common ancestor, and then we also share innumerable features of our biology, our anatomy, our cognitive capacity, our physiology. And it's evident. I can speak forth on that as much as you'd like, but it's, you know, it's really obvious when you look into the, you know, the eyes of a chimpanzee in the wild, you see yourself reflected back. It's a really uncanny kind of experience.
So chimpanzees are apes, and there are also other apes. Am I not right? Orangutans and gorillas.
Yep, absolutely. So a major distinction of the primates of the old world, meaning the primates of Africa and Asia, is that there are two main groups. There are the apes on the one hand, and then what we call monkeys on the other. Monkeys and apes are quite different in a number of respects. Apes are typically larger in body mass. There's no tail in apes. They tend to be more encephalized, which means a larger brain mass to body mass than the monkeys. Within the apes, there are two groups. There are the so-called great apes and then the so-called lesser apes. Now, when people think of apes, they generally are thinking about the great apes. The great apes are, as a group, our closest living relatives. Chimpanzees are one of the great apes. The great apes include the bonobos or pygmy chimpanzees of Africa, the gorilla that most people are familiar with, and then the two chimpanzee species. In Asia, we also have a great ape, and that is the orangutan. The other kind of apes are the lesser apes, and those are only found in Asia. Those are the Siamangs and the gibbons that are you know, mostly distributed in rainforests of South and Southeast Asia. So those are the apes. We've got the great apes and the lesser apes, and in Africa we've got bonobos, pygmy chimps, and gorillas.
And you've worked with chimpanzees primarily, as well as red colobus monkeys.
That's right. I've also worked with gorillas, and then chimpanzees. And of the monkey species, which is the other major, what we call clade or the grouping, I've worked with a number of those species. So red colobus, black and white. Red-tailed monkeys are probably the species I've spent most time with, the monkey species. They're quite small. They're a lovely species. They are about 3.5 kilograms, so just a little bit, or maybe around 10 to 15 pounds. And they've got brightly colored faces, they've got blue on their face, and they've got these sort of flashy, long red tails. So, yeah, I've had the good fortune of studying a number of those animals in the wild.
And can you tell a cognitive difference between the colobus monkeys and the chimps?
Oh, interesting question. Yes, you can. There are even differences between the different monkey species. And so this animal that I was just mentioning, the red-tailed monkey, is in a different group than the colobus monkeys. And the red-tailed monkeys do, in fact, have larger relative brain size to the colobus monkeys. And then overall, the monkeys relative to apes, there are indeed obvious cognitive differences. So tool use is one of the ways that we kind of think about cognitive capacity in non-human species. For a very long time, it was thought that the only primate species, the only animal species that not only used tools but made tools were humans. Of course, this was all turned on its head in the 60s when Jane Goodall described for the first time chimpanzees not only using tools but making them. And those first tools that were observed in use were described by Jane in the early 60s, and this was with regards to termite fishing. She observed chimpanzees creating these, what she called kind of fishing poles or termite poles, using these branches to extract termites from their termite mounds. Now what we know about chimpanzees is they have an extremely complex toolkit across their distribution in equatorial Africa. One of the more recent assessments that I've read suggests that they use over 300 different kinds of tools within, across their various sites in Africa. Chimpanzees have been found. A close friend and colleague of mine, Dr. Jill Preetz, was the first to observe and document chimpanzees using spears, in fact, to hunt. So chimpanzees in West Africa will create spears. They take a branch, they crack off the end of the branch to make it sharp, and then they will use those spears to hunt small prey, small mammals, usually little mammals that are called bush babies or galagos. So chimpanzees will hunt with spears. They will use medicine. This sounds really unlikely, but in fact it's been documented in a number of chimpanzee populations, the use of medicinal plants to cure stomach upsets, to cure diarrhea, parasites in the gut. So medicine, hunting with spears, they will use kind of hammer and anvils to crack open nuts. Now, there are a few non-ape species, non-chimpanzees, that will use tools. For example, in the New World, capuchin monkeys have been noted to use rocks to crack open nuts, but it's not with the same complexity and the same kind of diversity of tools that we see in common chimpanzees. Gorillas do not use tools in the same way that common chimps do. Orangutans in Borneo and Sumatra have been observed to use tools, but not as many as chimps, and the same is true for the bonobo as well. So tool using, and not only tool using, but tool making, yeah, I think that's probably one of the most striking examples of cognitive differences of apes from monkeys.
In an evolutionary sense, can it be determined how far back the use of tools goes?
Oh, really good question. So the deal with tool use is in the fossil record is that we can get a sense of the timing and the date and the location of tool use as long as those tools are made out of rock, right, minerals, stone. And the deal is that most of the tools that chimpanzees are using and other species are using are not made out of rock. There are, with the exception of hammer and anvil, those are in fact made out of rock. But, you know, it's thought that even in our own lineage, in the hominin lineage, that we were using tools long before what we call the Paleolithic, which is the stone tool age, that we were using tools before then. In the form of, say, made out of bone, perhaps made out of, branches. But the fossil record doesn't record that stuff as well.
So actually, apes and monkeys aren't the only tool users. We have otters
that use stones to crack open shells. So
that's right. Yeah.
Are other species that use tools?
Yeah, so that's an excellent point. So there are, in fact, other species that use tools. So as you just noted, sea otters, which have delighted people along the Pacific coast for so many years, will absolutely, and if if you spend any time, say, in California and Monterey, you may have seen this. They'll dive down to the bottom of, you know, whatever bay they're in. They'll grab, say, you know, some kind of crustacean from the bottom of where they're foraging. They'll grab a rock. They'll bring the animal and the rock up. They'll lay on their back in the ocean, and they'll crack open those crustacea with those rocks, and it's just this wonderful thing to observe. And, of course, many corvids, crows, ravens, jays, will use tools in one way or another. It's thought to be sort of distinct from the tool use that we see in humans and chimps, and that for the most part these are tools that are not manufactured by otters, right? So otters aren't making the tools that they are using. So some have called that not true tool use, but something that's been called object manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit of a, you know, academic exercise, you know, it's on how to distinguish what the different kinds of tool use, and there are different ways of describing it and referring to it. But that there is no other species besides humans, our lineage, and common chimpanzees that has the diversity of tools that we have, although absolutely other species will use, you know, things like rocks and twigs.
Does tool use relate to intelligence?
It seems to, right? Because if you think about what is involved in using tools, there needs to be a plan, right? A plan with a purposeful goal. So if you think, you know, so if you think about, say, I'm a chimpanzee, I'm a female chimpanzee, I'm working my way through the forest and, say, in the Thai forest of Ivory Coast, and I come to a tree, or I may even, you know, remember that there is a tree that is usually in fruit at this time of year. So I make my way as this female chimp to that palm tree with the expectation that there will be palm fruit that, you know, that tree will have at this particular time of year. But I know as a female chimp that I'm unable to open that palm fruit unless I have some way of cracking it.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are a number of steps involved in that, right? Lots of goals, lots of pre-thought-out planning. And because in addition to knowing that that tree is fruiting at this time of year, knowing that I'm not able to open up those nuts unless I have an a stone and an anvil, and then bringing with me and it's not just one tool, it's two, because you need the anvil, you need the rock to put the palm fruit on, and then you need the other rock as the hammer to crack it.
Right.
And so, you know, if you think about all of the intervening steps, all of the planning, and all of the goals that are involved in that, and the forethought, you really get a sense of that cognitive capacity.
Yeah, now we're talking about problem solving, aren't we?
Yes, indeed.
So, do primates exhibit other problem solving capabilities?
Absolutely. It's quite extraordinary to observe. And, you know, although there are differences in cognitive capacity across the order primates, overall primates are recognized to be, you know, one of the three most so-called intelligent order of mammals. The other two, of course, are the order Carnivora, which are, you know, the carnivores, and then the order Cetacea, the dolphins and the whales, also have good problem-solving capability. But the primates, they really max out on this. And of course, the, you know, humans and the great apes being, you know, really standing out amongst all species on the planet in terms of the problem-solving abilities. But any non-human primate is extraordinarily good at solving problems. There's a very large and rich literature in an area known as evolutionary psychology, and this is something that really stems from what is more traditionally been called comparative psychology. Comparative psychology is the study of non-human species to gain insight into the psychology of humans. Well, that has a long tradition in science in the Western world of, you know, over the last 100 years or so. And more recently, that has taken on kind of an evolutionary context with comparative psychologists really looking at questions related to problem solving from the perspective of evolution. You know, getting at questions of why has problem solving been of such evolutionary, you know, sort of significance, right? Why would natural selection create result in highly intelligent species? Because so a lot of the work that is done on intelligence is done with captive animals by comparative psychologists, evolutionary psychologists that basically set up kind of experiments, you know, in problem-solving experiments and setting up certain kinds of challenges to, say, chimps or capuchins or macaque species, getting them to, you know, work through many steps and then ultimately solving a problem that requires multiple steps. And then the reward at the end is typically something like, you know, like a peanut M&M or a raisin or some kind of treat. And when you do that with primates, they really stand out in terms of the total number of problems and the number of steps involved.
When you work with primates, have you developed any opinions in regard to whether they exhibit a sense of ethics or morality?
Oh gosh, that's a tricky one, right? I guess there's some semanticity to that, you know, of what is morality, and there is sort of what we might call anthropocentric perspective on that. You know, we're coming at that notion of morality from through the lens of being human.
Right.
If we come up with a more, how should we say it, species neutral sense of morality, you know, maybe a sense of what is fair, I would say that yes, I think that there is an awareness of amongst the, you know, individual, say, chimpanzees or baboons, of what is or is not fair. And what I mean by that is what is and is not appropriate behavior.
Mm-hmm.
If you see what I mean. So, and if you think about it that way, we lose the anthropocentric kind of sense of morality and start thinking about it in terms of measurable behavior. And yeah, like when certain individuals, say chimpanzees, and this is not just true for chimps, but would be true for any social species, you know, so even horses, wolves, you know, when there are individuals in a social group that are behaving inappropriately, maybe overly aggressive, or maybe taking food when it, you know, at a time that's not appropriate, there are repercussions, right? Social repercussions to that. And so there is indeed an awareness in these social species, including our social primates, that some behaviors are not cool with the rest of the group, right? Like, If in the case of horses, if you've ever watched wild horses, you know, when an individual is acting out, you know, the dominant mare, female, will discipline that individual. You've seen that probably in Wolves of Yellowstone, you know, when there's inappropriate behavior and disciplining of pups.
Right.
And certainly you see that in primates of this awareness. Whether or not we call that morality is, you know, that again, that's very anthropocentric.
Yeah.
Because from one individual to another in our own world, you know, we each have a different sense of what is morally correct or not.
Joanna, I'm afraid we're running short on time, but before we quit, I wanted you to address the question of how the wolf recovery program is going in Colorado.
All right, sure. As a citizen of Colorado, yeah, and I was indeed sort of active in that. So the Proposition 114, as you know, that was voted in November in 2020 of the general election of 2020 is now law. It is now firmly within the hands. The ballot initiative basically requires Colorado Parks and Wildlife to develop a science-based plan to reintroduce and manage gray wolves. And those reintroductions by law need to occur by December 31st of 2023. The other big part of the law is that there be fair compensation provided to producers, livestock producers, for any losses caused by gray wolves. So it is within the hands of Colorado Parks and Wildlife. There are every week a number of conversations going on with that. There are two advisory groups that are working with Colorado Parks and Wildlife, putting together, there's a technical working group that is putting together their recommendations to CPW on the technical aspects of the reintroduction, and there's also a stakeholder advisory group comprising a number of various stakeholders from around the state and giving their input on the plan. So stay tuned on that. The details of the plan have not been yet made public, but they're still working on it.
So they still have almost 2 years to bring in wolves. Will they be imported from Canada or from Montana, or where are they coming from?
So that has not been made public yet.
Oh, okay.
I think those kind of details are still being worked on. The plan, as being put forward by CPW, as I understand it, will be made public sometime probably during the summer of 23.
Uh-huh.
And then the wolf so-called pause on the ground, as I understand it, will be taking place very late in 2023. So, yeah, we're a good year and a half away from that. It's not clear yet where the wolves are coming from. There are a number of propositions of where those wolves could be coming from, Montana, Wyoming, maybe even private landholders who have wolves on their property.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the details of exactly where they're going or exactly how many wolves, those are all being worked on and will be part of the plan that's going to be put together ultimately by CPW and made public in sometime, sort of mid-2023 or towards the end of the summer, early autumn, as I understand it.
Joanna, we've run out of time. Thank you very much. It's been great to talk to you again.
As always. Thank you.
Our guest today has been Dr. Joanna Lambert, professor in Environmental Studies Program at the University of Colorado. In addition to her work in Yellowstone, Joanna continues her research in equatorial Africa on endangered primate species such as chimpanzees. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, Google Wilderness and Wildlife and go online to js-wilderness.com and see additional features of our website. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Shell.